Welcome to the MedFree Mental Fitness Podcast, a space for honest, thought-provoking conversations about mental health, medication, and the alternative paths people have taken to find healing and wholeness. I'm Katinka Blackford-Newman, life coach, journalist, and author of a book about my own experience with the life-altering impact of mental health medication and my recovery. In this episode, we delve into the explosion of mental health diagnoses, the often arbitrary nature of these labels, and the very real harm that can result when human experiences are pathologized instead of understood. Today, I'm honored to be joined by Laura Delano, whose new book, Unshrunk, How the Mental Health Industry Took Over My Life and My Fight to Get It Back Again, is making waves. Laura, first of all, congratulations. Your book has had an incredible response.
Oh, well, it's definitely been a roller coaster, and it's such an honor to be here. I'm so happy to be with you on the podcast.
Laura's story is quite extraordinary. Diagnosed with bipolar at just 14, she spent the next 14 years in and out of the best psychiatric hospitals, taking 19 different medications and given various other diagnoses. Then at 27, she began to question everything, her diagnosis, the medications, and whether they were actually the source of her suffering. Now, 15 years later, she's drug and diagnosis free and runs Inner Compass Initiative, a nonprofit dedicated to helping people make informed choices about their mental health. Laura and I share a very special connection. Our stories have unsettling similarities. I was hospitalized, misdiagnosed with multiple conditions, and put on more and more drugs that only made things worse. Unlike Laura, my ordeal lasted only a year. I just wanted to pause and say that you lost 14 years of your life. It happened to me for a year when I was 47. And for you, it took so many years of your adolescence. How do you make sense of that?
Well, for me, the difference is that because I didn't have an adult life, I had no kind of sense of self. Because I was psychiatrized at the very time in my life when I was about to start figuring out who I was and how to be in the world. So I didn't have to go through this disorienting experience of having a sense of who I was, of my work, of my relationships, and then have it all fall apart, and which itself is its own horror too. I don't have to have a midlife crisis 20 years from now or 10 years from now where I question everything I believe and my work and my relationships. I've already had that thanks to my psychiatrization. So in some ways it saved me a bit of an identity crisis down the line, you could say.
Well, I have to say that is a beautiful reframe that you've managed to see it as such a gift. So anyway, Laura, please tell listeners in your own words how it all began.
So I was born into a family with socioeconomic means. So I grew up in a wealthy town, went to private all-girls school, played lots of sports, had a lot of material comfort, which of course brought many gifts into my life. But at the same time, that environment was a really intense, highly pressured one as well. And so it wasn't that any particular individuals told me that I had to be perfect and the best to feel good about myself. It was more that was just the culture of my upbringing. And so when I was 13 in grade 8, there I was kind of on paper, had it all together, and had been elected the president of my middle school. And right as that was beginning, at the start of my school year, I was brushing my teeth in the bathroom one night before bed, and I was just staring at this girl in the mirror. And I just kept staring and staring until suddenly it was a stranger in the mirror. And I just stared at her like, who is she? Who is she? In retrospect, I see that I could have gone many different ways. I could have been like, oh, interesting. What do I care about? Let me go find that out. Or, whoa, cool. I just had this weird experience in the mirror and then moved on with my night. This could have gone many different ways. But for me, I think because I was this intense, sensitive, kind of insecure girl, so focused on having my act together all the time, the experience just freaked me out. I was terrified. And I felt completely alone in it, like completely convinced that I was some freak and that, you know, no one else felt this way. And at home, I began acting out, yelling, screaming. So my parents, understandably, just didn't know what to do with me. They were terrified and confused and disoriented. Eventually, just their fear led them to conclude they needed to send me to a professional. First, it was a therapist. The therapist referred me to a psychiatrist. And within one session, that psychiatrist told me that my anger and my irritability were symptoms of mania, and my depression or my despair and suicidal feelings and the self-injury were all symptoms of depression, and that I had this incurable mental illness called bipolar disorder, but that there were meds for that, so I shouldn't worry. And I was 14. And here was this adult authority figure telling me, basically, your brain is broken and it will be for the rest of your life, but don't worry, here's some meds. And so that began my journey.
Wow. Can I ask you, if you could teleport yourself back, what would you say to that younger self looking in the mirror, feeling that sense of isolation and desperation?
With hindsight, that experience I was having was quite profound and meaningful, and that those are important questions to grapple with when you're a teenager coming into yourself. The kind of despair I felt and the sense of alienation and the confusion and the apathy, and that all of those were actually signs of how wise I was and how human I was, and that they weren't signs that something was wrong with me. They were signs of how awake I was to the reality of the world around me.
And so what was wrong with the environment that you were in? Because from an outsider's point of view, it seemed to be very privileged. You had money, you had friends, and you were academically very successful and very successful sportswoman as well.
I think what I was waking up to was like, what's the point to the performance game? On paper, things looked good, but what is the value system that establishes that as what constitutes being good, that you have good grades? So much of who we are as people is tied into how we perform in our lives. We do lose a deeper, you could call it spiritual or philosophical or kind of existential realm of what it means to be human. We can lose touch with that, forget that. And so I think I didn't have any spaces or any people in my life or any resources like literature or film or anything to give me the opportunity to explore these deeper questions. And so I think in many ways that was the problem. That was what was going wrong, was that I lacked access to that realm of thinking and reflecting and exploring.
Okay, so it sounds like you knew intuitively at that age that this was a world to which your true values were not aligned, that you could play that game. But as your life has unfolded, it's turned out to be the truth as well, hasn't it? You're somebody whose life is defined by contribution. It's not defined by performance and success.
I've found my way there.
So what was your initial reaction to this diagnosis?
That same wisdom, I think, that had me questioning the society around me also questioned that psychiatrist, that first psychiatrist. And the second she told me that I had this incurable mental illness, I instantly knew that this was wrong, that this made no sense, that this is BS. And so she handed me two prescriptions at the time. I was 14, and this was 1997. She handed me a prescription for Depakote, which in the States is the brand name for Divalproex sodium. And it's classified as a mood stabilizer, quote unquote, but it's an anticonvulsant. And then she also gave me a prescription for Prozac and said, give these to your mom so she can get them filled for you, and I'll see you in a week. And I just, at any chance I had, I tried not to take them. if I'd hide them, I'd throw them out. They symbolized basically just how the world saw me, which was defective and in need of being fixed. And I refused to accept that. But that defiance only lasted a few years.
So the other drug was Prozac, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that, of course, was the time when Prozac was very popular in the States, wasn't it?
Prozac Nation had come out 3 years before, this book by Elizabeth Wurtzel. It was incredible advertising for the quick fix of psychopharmacology. And so I came of age at the time when that message that, oh, it's just a chemical imbalance in your brain, if you're feeling down, having a hard time, but don't worry. But what was also happening at the time that none of my parents certainly didn't know, there were very well orchestrated and drug company funded efforts underway to expand the market for bipolar disorder into children and adolescents. And so there were a few particular very prominent psychiatrists who were getting a lot of funding from drug companies to basically create this idea that we had an epidemic of undiagnosed bipolar disorder in children. And the reason that it was undiagnosed or unrecognized previously is that mania looked different in kids than in adults. So whereas in adults, you get grandiose and you have delusions and excessive spending or whatever it might be, in kids, mania looked like anger and irritability and outbursts and intense swings of mood. I mean, talk about a brilliant business model here for pathologizing adolescence. And so there I was, an angry, irritable, outbursting girl. And it was just perfect timing for me to get sucked right in.
Absolutely. And what child, it doesn't display all of those things. So initially, you reject the diagnosis. But does it sort of prey on your mind in that time that the psychiatrist may have been right?
That's such a good way of putting it. It did. I did my best to deny it, but the way I describe it is that a seed had been planted in me, like deep in me. And so through high school, even though I didn't accept that bipolar diagnosis, I continued to really struggle and despair at life. And so I kept up the good grades and the good sports and all that. And I got into Harvard and just begged the universe, please, please, please let this be what helps me feel okay in my skin. So when I got to Harvard at age 18, of course, that isn't what happened. And by wintertime, I was so spun out, and then had to go through the experience of coming out as a debutante in these very fancy balls in New York City. Like, here I am literally on a stage in a wedding dress. I really have no self here. I wanted to die so badly. That seed that had been planted by that first psychiatrist just burst forth and said, bipolar, bipolar, like, remember, you're bipolar. And I was like, oh my God, maybe she was right. And there's something wrong with me, because I literally can't be alive anymore. I can't do this anymore. Like, something must be wrong with me. And I went voluntarily back to psychiatry at that point and never looked back.
Well, you have looked back since.
Yeah, you're right. Never looked back until I looked back.
Yeah. For the next, what, however many years, 14, how many years then?
From
another
that point on,
years?
It was about 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
So you accept your diagnosis and then you start taking the drugs, I guess. Is that what happens?
I instantly took all of my perfectionistic, overachieving tendencies that I'd previously been applying to school and to squash, because I was playing squash in college, and just shifted those tendencies over to psychiatric patienthood and just clicked right into striving to be the best at it that I could be. So I would track my symptoms and I would keep him updated. If I was feeling intensifying problems, he'd up my meds or give me a new med. Or it just, I felt like I had this new purpose. My core struggle had been, what's the purpose to all of this, to life, to school, to all of it? And now suddenly I had a purpose to get treatment and to pursue my sanity. For a brief period of time, I felt good. I got my act together. I just clicked right in. And how much of that was actually because of the drugs, I can't say. How much of it was really more placebo effect that here I am, I have this new diagnosis, this new purpose. Like I have something new to pursue, this new thing outside of me that I can strive for. It might have been quite a bit of that. But that shift towards feeling better was pretty short-lived. And within a matter of months, I was having new sleep problems, agitation, a lot of things that I now in retrospect see were very likely adverse drug effects. But those were not recognized at the time as such. And so the meds started to pile up and two became three. And from that point on, it was just a progressive downward spiral through the rest of my 20s.
And what drugs were you on?
I think I was put back on Depakote and Prozac. And then I was put on Ambien not long after when I started having new sleep problems. So I couldn't sleep at night. So I had my Ambien and couldn't stay awake during the day. So then I was started on Provigil, which is an anti-narcoleptic drug. So I was literally taking this potent speed during the day to keep me awake for classes. And then at night, I was taking this Z drug because I couldn't sleep, plus the antidepressant, antipsychotic, whatever it might be.
What were the effects of taking all of those drugs on your everyday life?
They just profoundly altered every facet of my being. I just interpreted all of these worsening issues as me getting sicker. But my physical health declined steadily. I had chronic kind of irritable bowel syndrome kinds of issues. My weight fluctuated. So it fluctuated by 70 pounds once I was on the drugs. I had really worsening cognitive issues, my memory, my ability to absorb information, my ability to articulate myself. I just became increasingly disconnected from my body. I had no sexuality, zero sexual function whatsoever. I had a really hard time maintaining a sense of like a bondedness to friends or to boyfriends or to family. I just didn't feel emotionally connected to people. I mean, that's just scratching the surface of all the ways the drugs affected me.
But what I'm curious about is that how come you didn't read about it? How come you didn't read the, it's there in the product information leaflet. How come?
Oh, what a good question, Katinka. I think in part it was because I had this very powerful faith in doctors. So I didn't have a kind of critical thinking apparatus active in me. To be like, if I'm being given information, who created this information? And that's not me saying never listen to doctors. It's just saying, why don't we ask questions?
Well, you certainly started asking questions later on in your life. And part of the brilliance of your book, which we'll come on to later, is when you start to investigate the system. So in this time, you were also given multiple diagnoses as well, weren't you? Tell me about that.
Back when I first returned to psychiatry at age 18, I was given a diagnosis that I wasn't told about, which was borderline personality disorder. So I had that label without realizing it from age 18 on. And then over the years, I acquired social anxiety disorder, because interacting with the outside world got harder and harder. And I began drinking a lot because my life felt so numb and disconnected and meaningless. So eventually I got substance use disorder diagnosis. So yeah, I was a total mess. I was completely dependent on my family. I hadn't been able to hold down a job of any kind. By age 25, I'd been put on so many different meds that it was basically announced that I was just so sick that these treatments weren't helping me. And I officially had treatment-resistant bipolar disorder, which to me was just the most devastating thing I could hear, because my purpose in life was to get treatment so that one day I would feel okay. And so it was at that point that it really became only a matter of time before killing myself, to feel like the only logical solution to my treatment-resistant mentally ill life. And so at age 25, I overdosed. And to this day, I look back on that decision and I see the logic in it. And I understand why I made that choice. Because given the story that I was believing about myself, that I had this defective brain and would never be able to function because of how sick I was, that all that was in store for me was pills and psych wards and dysfunction and disability and dependence, that wasn't a life worth living for me.
I can totally imagine that. And also what I can imagine, because I've experienced it myself, was that the effect of the drugs would have played a large part in the way that you felt.
Being under the influence of those drugs was a critical piece of the puzzle that led me to eventually decide to kill myself. I like went quite far away from where my family was. I really, really wanted to die. And I thought this was a foolproof plan. And so the fact that my mom eventually just had this niggling sense in her, like, it's getting dark, Laura's not back, something's up, and that she asked my dad to go see if he could find me. And he could have gone so many different ways. He happened to go in the direction that I was in. I do think it was God, universe, something divine, something transcendent that made that day go the way that it went. Because I was in a coma for a while, and my parents were told, if she survives, she'll be a vegetable. It didn't look good. And then when I woke up, I was really not happy. Really not happy. Yeah. I was shocked that I survived.
And so what happens next?
I basically spent the next 2 years, so from ages 25 to 27, just continuing on more of the same, treatment-resistant, mentally ill life, not really able to work, not taking care of myself, blah, 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 more of the same. And I just, basically, I was living under the assumption that I would eventually get to the point where I was ready to kill myself again, and like this time, I wouldn't mess that up. But then things changed. It didn't go that way. It was at that point that I stumbled upon a book by Robert Whittaker called Anatomy of an Epidemic. Whittaker is a science journalist who basically went on this quest to look at long-term outcomes of psychiatric drug use in America. He basically made a very compelling case that on the whole, long-term use of psychiatric drugs is making us collectively sicker, more disabled, more dysfunctional. And when I read that book, I was on 5 drugs: lithium, Lamictal, Abilify, Effexor, and Ativan. I'd been a chronic mental patient, basically, for the previous decade, just getting worse and worse with each passing year, thinking along the way, it was all my treatment-resistant mental illness. And in this beautiful, agonizing moment, I realized, what if it's the treatment? Holy cow. What if it's the treatment? What if this story that Whittaker is telling in his book, what if I am this story? And that was basically the beginning of what has been this 15-year journey away from the mental health industry that I've been on ever since.
Wow. And that, it's just giving me goosebumps just hearing you talking about this, because that book changed the course of your life.
If what he's proposing is true, and I believe there is very strong scientific evidence base that it is, it means that potentially millions and millions of people have been unknowingly, at the very least, not helped, but even possibly harmed by very well-meaning doctors, the system that has set out to help us feel happier and more balanced and more peaceful has actually potentially done the very opposite. And the consequences of that are huge for individuals too. I mean, when I had to face this possibility that all of those years of my life never had to have gone the way that they went if I just hadn't seen a psychiatrist, at first I couldn't accept it. I couldn't face it. I was in shock. And it took me a while to really sink into this reality and to make peace with it.
So what was the decision you made after reading that book?
I realized I've been on these meds since I was a kid. Like, who am I? Who would I be off them? Because if there is another possibility for me than treatment-resistant mental illness or suicide, I owe it to myself to discover what that could be. I just knew I needed to come off to find out who I could be. And that determination outweighed the fears I had and all the lack of support from my doctors, who all thought this was a terrible idea. I just forged ahead. I didn't care what they thought anymore.
And how did you do it? How did you come off the drugs and what was it like?
So I came off 5 drugs in about half a year, which is basically cold turkey. I thought that was slow. My psychopharmacologist thought that was slow.
A big warning here to listeners that this is incredibly dangerous thing to do, to come off drugs quickly.
Yep.
Isn't it? So
yep.
You didn't know what you were doing.
I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't informed about how these drugs had altered my central nervous system in such a way that it had completely acclimated itself to the presence of these pills.
So, Laura, describe some of the withdrawal effects that you went through.
There were the wild ones, like spontaneous vomiting, boils breaking out on my skin, really nasty smells emanating specifically from my sternum, right? My breastplate, just rank rotting garbage smell, which is so wild to me. That was when I was coming off lithium. Migraines, terrible insomnia, terrible paranoia, racing thoughts, brutal physical agitation. And so it's a huge deal how far you guys have come over there.
Yeah, a lot of people who have been fighting for that as well, and to recognize that this continues after you've finished taking the drugs, that there are legacy effects of the drugs.
Indeed, very much so. The first year off, it was a big deal to take a shower for me. It really was in year 3 that I actually felt like I was alive and in my body, integrated in myself.
And tell me a bit about that awakening, what it was like to suddenly not be affected by these drugs after 14 years.
It's almost like waking up from a sleep you didn't realize you were in, and then simultaneously feeling what that's like, and then having to go through all the grief of recognizing that's been your reality. And for anyone who isn't there yet, just hang in there, because for some, the road is long, and just trust that the human body is just so profoundly capable and robust and resilient. The things that our bodies recover from, long-term psych drug use, rapid withdrawal, cold turkey, just sometimes it's time that our body needs more than anything.
And you talk very frankly in your book about how you were 27 before you had your first orgasm because the drugs had messed up with your sexual functioning.
Yep.
So had you realized that it was the drugs that had messed you up?
No. I had been thinking the whole time that it was because I was just so mentally ill that I couldn't feel good. And then that also, because I felt so numb and disconnected, I didn't bond when I was in relationships. It only was, as you said, it was only after I had my first orgasm that it all kind of clicked. And I was like, oh my God, this is what I've been missing out on. And like, this is what I've been thinking. Like, I thought it was me the whole time.
And of course, what we know about the drugs is that they they cause genital numbness. It's not a kind of psychological thing that in, I think it's something like nearly 70% of cases in studies that when you're on the drugs, it actually causes genital numbness, as well as rediscovering yourself and your sexuality and your feelings. As well, you go on a journey of discovery about the story that you've been given. Because a lot of people think, oh, if you're given a diagnosis of bipolar, that's like a sort of biological thing.
Indeed. And when I began to learn about all this, I had the same reaction that I had when I began to learn about the drugs, which was, how did I never think to ask about any of this before? Because it was so quickly, so clear to me that the DSM and the psychiatric diagnostic paradigm more broadly is not a scientific one. And so I had just assumed, if I'm given a diagnosis from the DSM, and I had my own copy of the DSM.
So the DSM stands for?
For the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders.
It's kind of like the Bible, isn't it, of psychiatric disorders. And I think when it started, there were something like 50 disorders, and now there are only over 300. And so the way that a disorder, a mental health disorder, is created is that it's voted on by a committee of psychiatrists. And so there was a time when homosexuality was deemed to be a psychiatric disorder, and then of course it was voted out. And so as time has gone on, there have been more and more diagnoses, and the criteria for existing diagnoses has loosened up to such an extent that of course now there's been an absolute boom in bipolar diagnoses, ADHD, autism particularly recently. For you, Laura, it wasn't hugely helpful, should we say?
It wasn't. I mean, at the beginning it was, though. It was so powerful to accept that diagnosis. I'm proud to be mentally ill. There's no stigma in this. I really took that on. It didn't help me, but I thought it did. I thought it helped me because I felt like I belonged somewhere and like I understood myself. That was how it was helpful, if it was helpful at all.
And of course, if a diagnosis is a way for somebody to get support, appropriate support, then of course that's incredibly helpful. But what your story illustrates is that it led you to take increasing doses of medication that was harming you. And that was the issue. And also, it seems as well that you started to lose agency in your own recovery.
Indeed.
But you certainly have agency now. So tell me, how is your life now?
I've been fully living life for well over a decade now, which has meant all kinds of wondrous and agonizing things. I would say that my life has been full and meaningful and connected and just rich in so many ways, as the direct result of all that darkness and of having the opportunity and being so blessed to be able to take what I went through and turn it into things that I can offer to others, whether it's the blog that I wrote for many years or starting this nonprofit Inner Compass Initiative that my husband Cooper Davis now runs and I'm involved in. I knew that I had to create an organization that could help other people access all the information and resources that my parents and I did not have at the very beginning. To me, this is all about informed choice. This is not about pro-med, anti-med, pro-diagnosis, anti-diagnosis. This is about helping people get access to straightforward, reliable information, to facts. Like, it's a fact that the average length of a psychiatric drug trial is 6 to 8 weeks. That's just a fact. You have the right to know that before you start that drug. And you have the right to know that you might not be able to get off this drug very easily if you stay on it. Like, they're just facts that people have the right to know. They're not being told.
So drugs were not the answer for you. So what is now in your mental health toolkit?
Well, part of it, I think, has been about reframing completely how I think about myself and mind, body, spirit. If I'm feeling really anxious and agitated and it's like lasting for days or weeks and I just feel like I don't have bandwidth, and instead of thinking to myself, what do I need to do to help my mind feel better? I'm like, what does my day-to-day life look like? I'm not eating enough, or I'm eating too much processed food, or I'm not getting outside, or I'm in front of my screen, or I'm just like not giving myself downtime. I'm literally filling every minute of my day with some kind of stimulation. There always are answers that I can kind of, for the most part, relatively quickly see are shaping how I'm feeling in any given day. So I think that's my, and that doesn't mean I should say that I then don't eat shitty processed food or don't be on my screen. I often still make those choices, but I at least recognize that when I feel the way I feel, I know it's not because of me and it's something inside of me. I know it's about my relationship to the world around me in some way. I just kind of trust in my own process with it. I don't force myself or coerce myself into self-care activities. I just kind of trust that if I'm just in a life chapter right now where I'm in front of my screen too much and I'm not getting outside. But when I'm ready, I'll shift out of this and I'll be outside. And usually I find that I find my way there kind of organically. I will say that diet, like what I put in my body and on my body, perhaps the most important variable that I look to. And I take that really seriously because the pharmaceutical industry is not the only industry that is selling us stories about what to consume that actually lead us further from health. So that's a big thing too. But I think meaning, purpose, social connections, being of service, getting out of self, being in nature, creating opportunities to be struck by the wonder of this world that we're in, for all its darkness and struggle and corruption and greed and all the flaws of the human condition, there's so much beauty that's always there if you make space to feel it. And I guess at the heart of it is that I still struggle a lot. I still have tons of pain, physical pain, emotional pain. I'm just not afraid of it anymore. And that's the biggest difference, I think, is that I was taught by the psychiatric paradigm to be terrified of my emotions and my thoughts and to basically feel at the mercy of them. And now I realize, like, I'm actually very much in the driver's seat of my life. The choices that I make will shape how I feel. There's a lot beyond my control that shapes how I feel too, but I don't have to be afraid of what happens in the space between my ears. I think that's been the biggest liberation out of all of it.
And that is a beautiful, beautiful takeaway, because what you seem to be saying is that you listen to your emotions and that you embrace your emotions, which of course is the opposite of what antidepressants and antipsychotics do, which they numb emotions. But you seem to be saying that living a life where your emotions guide you, even the negative ones, is that right?
I think it's also about developing the discernment to know when am I being driven by fear, for example, and that's actually an emotion to make space for and to listen to, but to not necessarily act on. So I think it's about, like, sometimes pain is a message to make a change in your life. Sometimes the pain doesn't need to be acted upon. It needs to be felt. And then by feeling it and being with it and making space for it, that's what then helps. Okay, what am I meant to do with this? Is this something that there's nothing to do with? I just need to feel this grief. Or is this something that I actually, need to move through and beyond? Like, that's the thing. This is what it means to be human. This isn't about happiness and put togetherness and balance and so-called mental health. This is about being yourself.
That is beautifully, beautifully put. And I think it so summarizes the importance of your journey. So just to revisit this, unfrunk, How the Mental Industry Took Over My Life and My Fight to Get It Back is now available everywhere, should we say?
It's available
on Amazon and everywhere.
In UK, Commonwealth countries, and then in the US, it's available with a different title. Unshrunk, A Story of Psychiatric Treatment Resistance is the US version.
Laura, thank you so much. Best of luck with your book.
So that's all from me, Katinka Blackford Newman. And if some of this resonates with you and you'd like to have a conversation about working with me as your life coach, then please contact me through my website, www.kbnlifecoaching.co.uk. That's www.kbnlifecoaching.co.uk. And please subscribe if you would like to continue to listen to more of these episodes.
Thanks so much for having me, Katinka. It's such an honor to be here.
And it's been fantastic to have you, and really just truly humbling to hear your story.
Thank you so much.
Amazing. For